During his career as a sports agent, Lee Steinberg has represented over 150 professional athletes, some of the most famous and successful football, baseball, and basketball players of our time. Forbes magazine has called him the greatest sports agent in history, and it's generally assumed that he was the inspiration for the title character in the film Jerry Maguire. And yet it all came crashing down in the early 2000s. With the help of Michael Arkush, Mrs. Steinberg has written a memoir about his rise, fall, and comeback. It's called The Agent, My 40-Year Career, Making Deals and Changing the Game. It's published by Thomas Dunn Books, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to our show.
A pleasure. You're a legend.
Well, so are you, and you represented so many of the biggest stars in football, including six number one overall picks. So how did you miss out with Peyton Manning?
Who's
is favored to win the Super Bowl.
Into each life, some rain must fall. I had represented Drew Bledsoe over Rick Meyer, and we used the same model again, which was probably the worst choice of my career.
Well, another of your clients, Ben Roethlisberger, didn't make it to very far in the playoffs. But do you root for your clients? I mean, or ex-clients?
Absolutely. You have to have passion, and they want you to see them play live. So you need to be part of that experience. So I've had 60 first-round draft picks in football, and the very first pick in the first round 8 years. There were weekends we had half the starting quarterbacks and seven players in the Hall of Fame.
Did they have a sense of rivalry at times because you're trying to get the best deal for the one who was picked first and then a little less great deal for the next guy and a little less for the next guy?
It actually helped to have multiple picks or multiple players at the same position because you could bootstrap the negotiations and actually set the market. My client, since we had carefully picked them because they could serve as role models and retrace their roots, were a little brighter, and I wanted players who understood their role in triggering imitative behavior.
And you have some pretty impressive people here who've worked in their communities and created their own foundations, but you have had a couple of loose cannons as well, like Ricky Williams.
Well, about 120 of the players have established scholarship funds at their high schools. Players like Troy Aikman and Eric Karros, a scholarship at their college, or Kerry Collins at Penn State.
And then Dikembe Mutombo.
Then we triggered them to set up a foundation that would somehow enhance the quality of life. So for my first one was Rolf Benerska for endangered species in San Diego, but Warwick Dunn's put 131 women, single women, into the first homes they'll ever own.
A listener is asking, what does it take before you'll drop a client? How would you have responded to the Ben Roethlisberger rape charges?
You know, I had stopped representing him at that point. The only way to deal with untoward behavior is wrap your arms around the facts, apologize quickly, take responsibility, and talk about steps you've taken to prevent a recurrence. So in damage control, that's what should happen. I would have to understand the facts. Obviously, that's not my model. My model is role model athletes.
But you are a lawyer as well, so you understand it from the other side as well.
So the point is that young men are young men, and when they have an incident, that would not qualify as an incident, that would qualify as a tragedy. You don't throw them on the trash heap of history. They're still maturing.
Although we have heard way too many cases, instances of athletes being accused of rape, just another one yesterday, and you wonder whether it isn't because they feel that they have special privileges. They've been made to feel like they can get away with things that other people can't.
I think if you took the actual statistics of their non-athletic peers at the same age group, you would find higher levels of drunk driving, drug use, domestic violence, and the rest of it. We have a media today that is so focused on aberrational behavior, and then it has a recurrent news cycle. So you'll see the same story over and over and over again.
My guest is Lee Steinberg. His latest book, I can say that, this is your second?
Yes.
It's called The Agent, My 40-Year Career Making Deals and Changing the Game. It's published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Do you see yourself as a child of the 60s? Weren't you at Berkeley in the mid-60s?
I was at Berkeley in the midst of long hair and wonderful music and all the rest of it.
Free and speech and anti-war demonstrations.
We were after free speech. We were very much anti-war demonstrations. They shut the campus down three straight quarters. Reagan was the governor, and I ended up being the student body president. So we duked it out. Every time he repressed us, his ratings went really high. So one day he wanted to fire the chancellor, and I had to go before the Board of Regents to defend him. And he looks over at me and he says, "Weren't you the same Mr. Steinberg that was arrested sitting in front of troop trains in Oakland in 1960? And I responded, "Well, Governor, I was about 10 years old and much closer to playing with toy trains." But that shows your usual adherence to accuracy and fact. And then it got going. And he actually later gave me a presidential commendation, and we laughed about it. But those were some wild days.
A major theme of the book and throughout your life is serving the community and infusing a commitment to social responsibility throughout your work. Did those ideals develop before you got to Berkeley?
My father raised my brothers and I with two core values. One was to treasure relationships, especially family. And the second was to try to make a positive difference in the world and help people who couldn't help themselves. So my brothers and I were hardwired from being young that whatever we did in the world had to have value and had to enhance people's lives. So I was well on the way before Berkeley.
And then you went to UC Berkeley Law School. So what kind of lawyer did you think you'd become?
I thought I'd be a criminal attorney. I loved Clarence Darrow, fighting for the underdog. Perry Mason and Judd for the defense, and a show called The Defenders inspired me. And when I got to law school, I couldn't understand what all the classes were because this isn't criminal law. So after I took a trip to Egypt, got real skinny, I was choosing between different law offers, and one of them was the Alameda County DA, which I probably would have taken. I had some in TV news, but politics was really my passion. And before I ever got there, Steve Bartkowski, who had been one of my counselees in the dorm.
He was a star quarterback at Berkeley.
He was, and I had sort of been his dorm counselor. And he asked me if I'd represent him. So there I was, Leonard, brimming with legal experience, never having practiced before. And I had the first pick in the first round of the NFL draft, and I was like 25 years old.
He was picked before Walter Payton, who is one of the greatest running backs to ever play the game.
Absolutely. That was so we have a World Football League competing against the NFL, and we were able to get the largest rookie contract in NFL history to eclipse Joe Namath and O.J. Simpson, the previous standard bearers. So we get back to Atlanta to sign the contract, and there are Klieg lights flashing in the sky at the airport. A huge crowd is pressed up against the police line, and the first thing we hear is, "We interrupt the Johnny Carson show to bring you a special news bulletin. C. Bartkowski and his attorney have just arrived at the Atlanta airport. We switch you live for an interview." So I looked at him probably like Dorothy looked at Toto, and I said, "Bart, we're not in Berkeley anymore." That's when I really saw the idol worship and veneration and how we could use athletes to trigger imitative behavior.
And you did very well in those negotiations, despite the fact that you'd never done them before. But you must have learned things later that you wish you had known then.
Absolutely, in terms of structure and the rest of it. My experience was primarily political. So I'd been student body president in a number of places, and I understood that process. So I did not have to be Mensa or a nuclear scientist to know when you have two competing leads, that's leverage.
And then you had to go about building a stable of clients. How do you do that?
I articulated this philosophy that we've talked about and then screened clients so that someone who was a little more ambitious, had some social conscience, would be someone I'd represent. So those players led to the same players.
Well, okay, you could have had this accidental opportunity with Steve Bartkowski and then gone back to the DA's office, but you decided that this is what you wanted to do?
Again, my father's admonition, I had a revelation at the airport in the Bartkowski experience that as opposed to traditional politics or law, I could do much more good by working with athletes.
So you built up this, you got other athletes, basketball, baseball, even boxing, but focus primarily on professional football players. Was it a good strategy to focus on one sport?
It just evolved that way. So I ended up with half the starting quarterbacks. We had 90 players, 80 had been to the Super Bowl. We had a big baseball practice with my partner Jeff Morad and CeCe Sabathia and Sean Green, a whole series of players in basketball. Then in boxing, I ended up for Lennox Lewis negotiating the biggest fight contract ever.
Well, in terms of negotiating strategy, what are some of the main differences in representing a first-round draft pick in the NFL or Major League Baseball or the NBA?
The systems are different. So in baseball, it's very age-oriented. So a player in his first few years is at the mercy of a team. There really is no negotiating. And then year four through six, they have arbitration, and then they become free agents. So that's why you see a 267 hitter getting $10 million a year and Mike Trout on the Angels making $700,000. We now have a cap system. So all the clever fun we had being creative on contracts is gone in football. It's a pretty strong salary cap, and it's that way in basketball too. So the it comes with the veterans, that's when it's interesting.
And in baseball, you don't have a cap, but you do have a system in which you're fined if your payroll is too high.
A luxury tax, exactly.
The Yankees know all about that. My guest is Lee Steinberg, who, with the help of Michael Arkush, A-R-K-U-S-H,
yes.
Is that Arkush, has written a memoir called The Agent, My 40-Year Career, Making Deals and Changing the Game. It has a foreword by Warren Moon. We'll talk a bit about Warren Moon in a little while. It's published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. We'll be back right after this. We are back with Lee Steinberg, his memoir, The Agent, My 40-Year Career, Making Deals and Changing the Game, published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. Yours is a notoriously cutthroat business. You write about some of the more creative ways you've been duped or taken advantage of by fellow agents, including on your wedding day.
Yes. So I'm on my honeymoon, and we found out that an agent who had been with us was calling clients of ours because he was going to leave the practice. Well, great honeymoon.
Sounds like The Good Wife.
Great honeymoon. I mean, that's one of the stories I told Cameron Crowe for Jerry Maguire.
And then you discovered you were on an enemies list from another agency.
It is amazing. I thought there'd be collegiality in the business, and instead, people think it's the functional equivalent of war. See, and My whole life has been refuting situational ethics. So if you go home and you're nice to cats and dogs and you're a great father and then go out in the workplace and use heinous social Darwin tactics because after all the end justifies the means, I think that leads to a soul death.
But you have other problems, not just other agents trying to steal your clients. You also have to deal with all of the hangers-on, other people who want to take advantage of your clients. And what are some of the very basic things you tell a client to be alert for?
First of all, they're in a public a business that rests on discretionary fan entertainment spending. So if they're not willing to comport themselves in a way where they are not involved in fights or DUIs or domestic violence or any of that, if they don't want to graciously talk to reporters or sign autographs, then go play on the sandlot.
Well, you also, I'm sure you had a number of clients where you'd say, this is a great deal, and then they're friends would say, oh, you're better than that. You can make a lot more money.
Leonard, have you been in the agency business? That is so true. But the reality is I tried to educate them so that it was an educational experience. They could see the comps. What I would do with a client is ask him to list his values, how he felt about short-term dollars, long-term dollars, family, ability to be a starter, and the rest of it. You really have to understand the deepest anxieties and fears and greatest hopes and dreams of a client. Men don't share so easily, so you have to be silent enough to allow them to peel back the layers of the onion.
I'm assuming that you also liked negotiating with certain team owners more than others.
Absolutely. The San Francisco 49ers are dealing with Jerry Jones. There were owners, especially Jerry.
Were they positive or negative, those?
Positive.
Oh. Jerry
Jones and Bob Kraft, where I had the best player on their team, were two owners that understood how to expand the brand of football, how to use social media, how to use fantasy sports, how to all the platforms, and they brought new vigor and excitement to the league.
You've had many A-list clients over the years, but a few of them seem to really stick out. Warren Moon, for example, Troy Aikman, Steve Young. Is there something special you can tell us about each of these quarterbacks? Well, with Warren Moon, you were fighting a racial bias in those days. There were no black quarterbacks.
No, there weren't. And there was a sense that those middle positions, center, quarterback, middle linebacker, and safety were white positions. And he also had been—
Because they thought they required more intelligence?
Yes. And there was also the issue of having a black quarterback as the representative to the city. So Warren went to Canada because he didn't want to stay there. And then when we came back in 1984, he was a free agent. He was the first free agent. And we went on a trip across the country. I remember a headline back here, New York Gents Shoot the Moon. And he signed the biggest contract in NFL history, and then he went on to have 17 more years in the NFL.
And now he's in the Hall of Fame.
And I gave his presentation speech. We grew up together. Since 1978, he's been a fixture in my life, and these are personal relationships.
The other two that I mentioned, Troy Aikman and Steve Young, also appeared in a film, frontline documentary called League of Denial, the NFL's Concussion Crisis, which aired last October. You described a 1993 hospital visit with Troy Aikman after he'd suffered a concussion in a playoff game against the 49ers.
I had a crisis of conscience when it came to concussion. Here I was enriching players in their bank book while potentially sending them out as an enabler into a sport that might cause dementia. I was terrified. San Francisco had played Dallas. Dallas had won. Troy's in a darkened hospital room. And I enter, and he looks at me and says, where am I? And I said, well, you're in the hospital. What happened? I had a concussion. Did I play well today? Yes. Did I throw any touchdown passes? Yes. What does it mean? It means you're going to the Super Bowl. About 5 minutes passed, and his face brightened. About 5 minutes passed, and he said, "Where am I? Did I play today?" Five more minutes
just
passed.
Just like Alzheimer's.
And it terrified me how tender the bond was between sentient consciousness and that. So I held six concussion conferences trying to get to the facts of it. The first ones were early on, and the league response was to say I was a fearmonger. So in 2007, we had the leading neurologists from across the country, and they presented that three or more concussions cause an exponentially higher rate of Alzheimer's, premature senility, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and I called it a ticking time bomb and an undiagnosed health epidemic. I now believe that every time an offensive lineman hits a defensive lineman at the inception of a football play, it causes a low-level concussive event. So you could have an offensive lineman leaving football who's had 10,000 subconcussive hits, the aggregate of none of which he's aware of, the aggregate of which is so much worse than getting knocked out three times. So it's an existential threat to football.
Steve Young suffered a career-ending concussion in 1999. We see Troy Aikman doing color commentary these days. He seems to be okay. Is this something you can recover from? How is Steve Young doing?
We right now do not have a whole lot of options. They have an Amen clinic, which has done well with about 160 players, and they use, among other things, hyperbaric oxygen. But we desperately need helmetry. I'm helping Tate Technology. They have a helmet which does more than the current helmets. They just protect against skull fractures.
So why aren't they being used?
So they've just developed a way to dissipate the energy wave, attenuate it through an energy coil with Jenny Morgan. We also need desperately research into nutraceuticals and pharmaceuticals that have the potential to do what you ask, which is heal the brain.
What do you make of the NFL's recent settlement with retired players and the families of players who have since died?
Well, it just got set aside by a federal judge, and it is the National Football League could never afford to let that case go to trial because it was pretty clear in a book like League of Denial that they ran studies, they showed there was damage, and they didn't tell the players. So that amount of money is so infinitesimal compared to the number of people that are going to have these symptoms that it's just not sufficient.
Another dirty secret in professional sports is that many players go bankrupt after their playing days are over. Why does that happen? Some of these guys make millions of dollars.
So on the college campus, when they're initially picking agents and financial planners, it's a tale of two cities. On the one hand, you have our type of clients who've got parents involved, who have schools involved, who do rigid screening and due diligence. They pick good financial planners. So the Steve Youngs and Warren Moons and Troy Aikmans have all sorts of options. I have three ex-clients who are minority owners of NFL teams, work done Ray Childress and Daron Terry. On the other side, you've got players who are completely unprotected. They fall prey to unscrupulous people who don't teach them about budgeting, who don't teach them to do a financial plan.
Or, as in the case of Bobby Orr, steal their money.
Exactly. So the other big problem is divorce. Divorce is probably the number one factor in losing money, but you know, I've had clients like Steve Young and Brent Jones who have a couple billion-dollar hedge fund, Bruce Smith who owns part of a construction company and a luxury hotel. These players have done well.
My guest is Lee Steinberg. His book, The Agent, My 40-Year Career, Making Deals and Changing the Game. a blurb on it is from Forbes as the greatest sports agent in history. Of course, they're biased because you write a weekly column for Forbes. But still, considering the fact that you, most people say you're one of, if not the best, around 2000, 2001, the whole thing fell apart. Why?
It wasn't my job. I had a series of reverses in my personal life. My father died a long death of cancer. My dad was really the strongest figure of support in my life. Then my two kids were diagnosed with incurable eye disease. And they were young.
And then your marriage started falling apart.
Well, first we lost some houses to mold, so I felt like Job and the biblical, I thought, locust would be next. And then my marriage fell apart, and that was the slippery slope for me because I had never lived alone, and I found out it was legal to drink during the day. And I spiraled down in 2008-09, and by the time I got to 10, I was sitting in my parents' house, and my best thought was to keep drinking vodka. And finally, I had a moment of clarity and realized I was failing both my father's admonitions.
Well, you hadn't been a drinker.
First of all, there's...
You're a late alcoholic.
I grew up in a Jewish household. There was no alcohol. Then I was one beer Steinberg. I mean, I clearly remember all of that. But you can drink your way into alcoholism by just drinking too much, which happened to me late in life.
Now, you come from a rather prestigious family. Your grandfather's, on your father's side, John Steinberg, ran Hollywood hotspots like the Cafe Trocadero and the Jewish Hillcrest Country Club.
I grew up on the laps of George Burns, Groucho Marx, Danny Kaye, Jack Benny. George Burns took me to my first game. I sat on Marilyn Monroe's lap.
It's better to have Marilyn Monroe sit in your lap.
Thank you, but I was seven. I have an Elvis Presley autographed guitar.
Well, the reason I ask is, weren't family members interceding at this point, trying to help you
out?
You did go into rehab.
I went into rehab. I was the most excellent student in rehab. I could tell you everything about the dysfunctional family, everything about the chemistry of addiction. I just couldn't stop drinking.
So you started putting it back together. What's the situation today?
So it's been 4 years. In March, it'll be 4 years that I've been sober. We got refunded to relaunch again with a company that would do representation, do marketing. And then our business has expanded so that sports theme, motion pictures, television, video games, every app that can enhance experience, all these businesses are we can help and produce and own equity in.
Do you see other sports agents as having been influenced by you?
My mail would say that. So when I designed something like the Sporting Green Alliance that takes sustainable technology and wind, solar, recycling, resurfacing, and water, and put it into stadium, arena, and practice fields of high school, college, and pro, we drop carbon emissions, energy costs, and re-educate people.
Lee Steinberg will be doing a reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store on Broadway and 82nd Street. His book, The Agent, My 40-Year Career, Making Deals and Changing the Game, is published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
On tomorrow's show, Sarah Jessica Parker discusses starring in Amanda Peet's play, The Commons of Pensacola, about what it means to be a family. And then we'll talk to a young woman from Egypt who was sold into slavery at the age of 8 and how she was rescued 4 years later. Richard Power will discuss his latest novel, Orfeo. Also, Blank on Blank founder David Gerlach on his PBS series, which adds animation to archival interviews with everyone from Kurt Cobain to Barry White. Linda Robinson explains how the American military has turned to its special operations forces more and more over the years. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Debbie Darter is at the audio controls. We had help today from Todd McGovern and contributing producer Barbara Kahn. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy the rest of your Martin Luther King Day, and we'll see you tomorrow.